You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. As part of our continuing series on military recruitment, Peace Watch correspondent Ingrid Drake recently visited Cardoza Senior High School in Northwest Washington, D.C. Cardoza is unique for its diverse student body, comprised of recent immigrants from around the world and a large African-American population. Drake took a tour of the junior ROTC training facilities in the basement of the school, and she spoke with a guidance counselor about the choices students face when selecting extracurricular programs. She also spoke with students who are members of the junior ROTC, as well as those opposed to military recruitment in the school.
My name is Jamila Thompson. I'm a member of my debate team, journalism. I work on a campaign for students, not soldiers.
Hi, I'm Walter.
Debate.
Journalism.
Law explorers.
Hi, my name is Eugene, and I grew up in Ghana. It's in Africa. And I'm in JROTC.
Hi, my name is Keisha. I was born in Trinidad, grew up in Maryland, now live in D.C. I'm on the debate team and the Students Not Soldiers campaign.
I asked the students to explain JROTC and their school.
I think it's a good program. I joined it because I was very shy. It helps everybody, really. If you want to, you could join. And if you don't want, you just don't have to.
What if you're forced to? In ninth grade, they put it on your schedule, and most students don't know that they could take it off. Right? They don't tell them stuff like that. So they just do it, and then they put it on their schedule for another year, and they have to do it again.
Did you take it?
No, I took it off. Because I found out information about it.
That's okay. You took it?
I took it in my ninth grade year, and Major Notice, who was the coordinator of the program, he was very, very, very intent on getting me to join the military or consider joining the military. I didn't like it. All we read from a book that talked about the military and different positions and different jobs you can get in the military, and I didn't see how that, you know, correlated with my high school education because I had no interest in the military. Actually, after, you know, a few months and, being persuaded, I considered it, but, you know, I opened my eyes and I realized that wasn't what I wanted to do, and, you know, I couldn't be persuaded to do it.
What are some of the things that he said to you about why you should join?
Well, he told us, you know, how he owned the house and the military, you know, paid, you know, a lot on the house, scholarships, college education, integrity, how you would stand out in society because you were in the military, and how they're citizens and they're civilians, and how they differ, and how the military just puts you on a pedestal above other people. Before coming into JROTC, I knew the military, you know, was wrong. I've always felt that, you know, war was wrong, and sometimes the military was used in the wrong ways in this country. But I didn't know too much about the life of a soldier until I did an article on it about recruitment in high schools, and I went to a few panel meetings where they, you know, talked about how, you know, people didn't actually get all the benefits the military was supposed to give you, and how a small percentage of people actually got those high ranks or a full college education like the military was supposed to. Then I saw veterans, you know, on the street corners. When I was in the carryout, a veteran came to me and he showed me his card and he told me that he hadn't got his check yet. Could I buy him, you know, some fries?
Frankly, I resent the military and all the things it stands for. I'm not one to, you know, give up my life for the country that doesn't do nothing for me.
What did they do?
Nothing. The military, they lie, like with the weapons of destruction. They claim to find some weapon, which clearly is not there.
Really, I joined when I first came here because I thought it was interesting.
Because it was on the schedule.
And my sister joined this, so I just wanted to join and see how it is. And I kind of like this.
And what do you think about the things they're saying about the military?
I think some of it is true and some of it is not. But the military sometimes is wrong. And it is kind of like following the leader and all that stuff. But sometimes you have choice to make.
And, right. That's what I think.
And sometimes you don't. That's them.
That's true. Them. Like, the military is not all bad. It's just that the recruiting of high school students is bad because, you know, you want them to finish. You know, at least recruit when people come out of college and don't recruit them. Let them choose for themselves, you know. You present it to them in a way that you're not saying you have to come. You're saying if you want to, you could, but not to high school students. That's the bad thing about it.
And the No Child Left Behind Act. The No Child Left Behind Act has a clause that says that, you know, all public high schools are required to give the names of their students to the military, or they won't receive federal funding. And a lot of students didn't know about it because there were no notices sent out to parents or anybody. So we didn't know that we could opt out if we wrote to the superintendent until we found that out at the America Friends Service. We did a campaign in our school where we passed out, you know, cards to students and told them about the No Child Left Behind Act. All the students didn't know about it, and they were, like, frantic, like, I'm going to get recruited. What? They're going to call my house. They've been calling my house. We've been doing workshops where, you know, we go to different classrooms in the school and do activities where we find out what people knew about the military, the myths of the military, and gave them a different side of the story. We have recruiters coming in like once a week. They go to classrooms and tell students about, you know, how great the military is. And people hear this and, you know, think of it as a way out. There's a lot of pressure to join the military because our assistant principal, his son is in the military. And so, you know, he goes around telling students, well, you should be in the military instead of, you know, walking around with your pants sagging.
But, Eugene, can I ask you, what's going on in Ghana right now in terms of the military?
I think there's too much money wasted. They're wasting too much money on war and stuff instead of using it to help Africans, and they are help needed back there. But they're wasting all this money using it in weapons and all this stuff.
The JRTC program has a long history in the high school. When he was a student, J. Edgar Hoover was a member of the JRTC program. Sergeant Thomas, a JROTC teacher, gave me a tour of the facility, including the shooting range, but was quick to tell me the program did not promote the armed services to students.
Even though it's run by the military and it's funded by the military, our goal is to teach young people to become better citizens. I would say about 0.2% of our students, once they complete JROTC down here, or if they've been in the JROTC program for 4 years, they don't even go to the military. I know we have a lot of negativity out there about the program because a lot of people really don't know anything about the program, what the program is all about. The only thing they're saying that we're promoting the Army in high school. We got these kids down here marching all day long, and we got these kids down here doing this and doing. No, we teach classroom instruction. We get out there and teach. We teach marksmanship. We teach them how to shoot with a pellet rifle. We do not give every student a rifle. They have to take a safety class, and the safety class is for 1 week, and then they have a test. If they cannot pass the test, they do not come on this range to shoot, and they shoot pellets. They used to shoot 22s here, but we pull all the 22s out of the city, which I'm happy they did.
What is the relationship between you all and the actual recruiters?
They'll come out and see who we have in the program and we have any recommendations for anybody to go to the military. We talk to that student first before the recruiter to talk to him. So, son, go to college. You know, if you have the money, you can afford to go to college, go to college. And that's what we promote first. If you don't have the money to go to college and you decide to go to the military, then that's when we sit down and talk to them. A few years ago, I had a recruiter come in, told the kid that he was going to be a surveyor, and he's going to go out and just survey the property and do this and do that, regular engineer. I said, that's a bunch of bullshit. And I told him in front of the recruiter, I said, you're going to be out there surveying the artillery for the artillery gun. If a recruiter tells a kid something wrong, we're going to get on that doggone recruiter.
There are different reports about who pays for the JRTC programs. According to Sergeant Thomas, the D.C. Public Schools has not put forth any funds. Trent Moyer from the Students Not Soldiers program of the American Friends Service Committee said that in its 2004 budget, the DCPS will spend almost $2.5 million. Todd Schumacher is an AmeriCorps Vista service learning facilitator and has worked at Cardozo for 3 years. His job is to connect youth with community service opportunities and to coordinate the journalism class. He spoke about how student options for extracurricular activities are limited and how the JROTC is filling a much-needed shortage for the youth leadership development.
JROTC is probably one of the most popular activities at the school. They offer 4 different courses, JROTC 1, 2, 3, and 4. It's planned so that students take it over their 4 years of high school. From a student's point of view, it's great because it's a very strong program. They gain a lot out of it. They go on a lot of trips. From another teacher's point of view, trying to do other programs at the school, it seems like, you know, resources are kind of misallocated in a way where, well, there's not many resources for the arts program. We don't have a band at the school. There's not a lot of different sports teams. There's, you know, usually just a couple of teams that a student can join each, you know, each season. And even from the academic point of view, not a lot of extra spending to go on for the teachers for their actual classes. For example, you know, I went to just the business manager at our school and asked, you know, can we get a set of textbooks for our journalism class? And she said, no, we don't have no money. Maybe next year. And they haven't bought new textbooks in at least a few years. There hasn't, you know, been any money allocated towards new textbooks. And I have mixed feelings about it. You know, I know it provides, you know, a lot of discipline for students that maybe would lack it without it. In my eyes, though, I think it creates a lot of misperceptions in the eyes of the students, where they see leadership kind of drilling and carrying guns and practicing shooting. And, you know, I question, is that the only program, is that the best program to provide leadership training?
Can you talk a little bit about the youth organization that you used to work for and describe that and what its fate was?
I used to work for organizations called Community Impact, whose mission was to develop, you know, youth leadership through promoting, you know, youth-led community service advocacy projects. Its fate was that it lost funding. It was dependent on foundation support, on donations. In the end, when the economy kind of, you know, hit a snag in the stock market, all the funding for these.
In April 2000, six police officers arrived at the Tattered Cover bookstore in Denver, Colorado, armed with a search warrant demanding that owner Joyce Meskis turn over all patrons' records. Meskis refused, politely explaining this action violated her customers' First Amendment rights. In 2002, the Colorado Supreme Court agreed with her. As part of Pacifica's continuing series, A Clear and Present Danger, which explores the challenges of free expression in an open society, Joyce Meskis spoke recently with Stephen Rohde about the landmark case and about the threats of the First Amendment that are disguised in Article 215 of the USA Patriot Act.
Joyce, in the spring of 2000, your Tattered Cover bookstore was confronted with a police search warrant that led to a major First Amendment battle. Would you take us back to that time and explain what happened?
Indeed. There were five officers that came into our downtown store with a search warrant requesting that we turn over records relating to one of our customer's purchases. It was a mail order shipment that was legitimately sent, ordered by our customer and provided by us.
And did the police explain what they were looking for?
Not initially. When we first heard from the authorities with an administrative subpoena about a month earlier, they had sought all of the purchase records of this particular customer, which included in particular the mail order shipment that I just spoke about. Ultimately, with the search warrant, once we denied access to the administrative subpoena request, the search warrant was somewhat narrowed but required us to turn over all the documents we had regarding purchases of this customer for a one-month period, as well as specific information to a particular mail order shipment.
And did you subsequently learn what the Denver North Metro Drug Task Force was investigating?
It unfolded over time. We didn't know in the beginning, but in time we learned that the authorities had been investigating what they suspected to be a meth lab activity in one of the Denver suburbs. They had found in the trash outside of a particular trailer home what they referred to as a mailing envelope from the Tattered Cover. It was devoid of its contents, but there was a mailing label directed to one of the individuals who lived within the trailer home, and a shipment of a book or books was therein contained. The police didn't know what they were, but upon gaining access, entry to the trailer home, they did indeed find a small meth lab. They found a couple of books that they reported as being rather new-looking, and those books were on the manufacture of methamphetamines, they made the leap that those books may have been sent in that particular package by us to the individual in the trailer home.
At that time, what was your attitude toward the privacy of your customers' records at Tattered Cover Bookstore?
We have historically taken a very firm stand on First Amendment issues with regard to the right to read and, in particular, our customers' privacy. From our standpoint, privacy is absolutely crucial to the freedom to read, and the people in our democratic and free society be allowed to have access to materials of all different kinds and persuasions so that they can become critical thinkers. You don't always agree with what you read, at least I hope you don't. You may want to hear what the other side is saying at times. You may be a reporter seeking information to write a story. And so people read for all kinds of reasons.
So what was your reaction confronted with a search warrant eventually? How did you deal with that?
Well, it was a pretty daunting experience at first. The officers were very professional. They were dressed in civilian clothes. They were not jackbooted police coming in by any means. But they did have a mission, and their mission was going to be accomplished from their point of view. And they were determined that they would have access to this particular information. I felt strongly that they needed to hear the other side of the story, the First Amendment concerns, and spent a good deal of time talking about the Kramer Books case in Washington, D.C. of a couple of years earlier and what bearing it had on this particular exercise that they were embarking upon. To no avail. Finally, our attorney, Dan Recht, got on the phone to a number of folks and spoke to the officers directly and essentially bought a week's time before the search warrant could be effected. And in that time, we filed suit in the Denver District Court for a temporary restraining order first and then ultimately a judgment of the court.
Share with us the Kramer Books experience and how that related to your defense of the First Amendment.
Well, that was a very important case. One may recall that with Kenneth Starr's investigation of the Clinton administration, that he requested that Kramer Books turn over all of the documentation regarding Monica Lewinsky's purchases. Well, in the course of that, Kramer Books stood firm, and there were judgments by Judge Johnson along the way. She ruled that one cannot just, because they have the authority to do so, issue a subpoena requesting that all such documents be turned over regarding a person's reading habits, that there must be a clear connection between the investigation and the documents sought, and that there must be a higher standard adhered to on the part of the authorities. No longer could they rely on probable cause as a standard, but in fact they had to demonstrate a compelling need for the information. Now, this may sound like semantics, but I assure you that it's not.
During the course of your court battle, did you gain support from the community of libraries and bookstores and publishing associations?
Absolutely. I was very gratified by the fact that so many, hundreds literally, of our customers wrote or commented or emailed to us or telephoned their support of our stand because they recognized what it means to the freedom to read.
And then in April of 2002, the Colorado Supreme Court finally ruled in your case. And what did they decide?
They ruled in a unanimous 6-0 ruling that our position was one that they supported.
And that's a historic decision, and First Amendment advocates across the country celebrated that decision. The court held that the Colorado Constitution and the First Amendment protect an individual's fundamental right to purchase books anonymously, free from governmental interference. How did you feel upon winning that victory?
Absolute relief. In addition, one of our attorneys, upon reading the over 50-page document, said, Joyce, this is virtually a primer on the First Amendment. And indeed, he was absolutely right.
Only recently has it been divulged what that book was that had been ordered by that customer. Give us the most recent part of this story.
More than 2 years later, we were in a situation, my attorney and I were on a panel with actually the head of the North Metro Drug Task Force, she being the spokesperson for it, and their attorney. So both sides were represented. We both gave our sides to the story, and in the course of the question and answer period afterwards, there was a gentleman that stood in the audience representing that he was the public defender who had represented the suspect in this case. He asked us to confirm the title of the book that was in the shipment. He gave permission for that information to be divulged on behalf of his client. The authorities evidently had asked the suspect earlier what the title of the book was in the shipment, and the suspect had indeed given the information to the authorities, and now the attorney, the public defender, was asking us to confirm that. And so we did publicly for the first time at his behest. The book title had to do with a book of Japanese characters and had nothing to do with the manufacture of methamphetamine.
So all along, in a sense, the government had been on a fishing expedition, had even been incorrect in their original suspicions about the book itself.
Yes, and it speaks perhaps to an even larger issue. There was indeed a methamphetamine lab on the premises of that trailer home, and there was a lot of evidence there that was used to prosecute that suspect. And indeed, he was prosecuted and given a substantial prison sentence. The fact that they sought this additional information as to a book that was mailed in a package, I have to wonder how important it was in their minds when they had all of this other information there that certainly moved a successful prosecution.
Now, Joyce, at the outset of this controversy, you could have told the authorities by checking your records and the name of that customer that this was a book about Japanese calligraphy and put to rest this whole 2-year ordeal. Why didn't you do that?
We stood on the principle that we needed to protect the privacy of our customers. That is our job as booksellers. We support, certainly, the fact that the police are there in the interest of the public as well. But now, this was a matter of rights bumping up against rights and societal interest bumping up against societal interest. And it was very important for this issue to be heard in the court for a judge to make the appropriate decision weighing the First Amendment interests of the person who was involved in this situation against what was the interest of the authorities in upholding the law.
It's the protection of the principle of the First Amendment that's at stake.
That's absolutely correct.
Now, subsequent to the service of the subpoena on your bookstore, we suffered 9/11, and then we suffered the imposition of the USA Patriot Act and Section 215, which directly impacts libraries and bookshops by reducing the standard by which the government can subpoena and search records of bookstores and libraries.
That's right, and it's a very disquieting set of circumstances.
And would you explain to our listeners why you see it as a threat?
Well, it again diminishes the protections that the reader has with regard to the right to privacy, the right to read, the freedom to read that is so important. The Patriot Act has gone a far step forward beyond what was reasonable in the past with the FISA Act in terms of national security and so forth. The standard is so low with regard to the Patriot Act that investigators, just because they may suspect some terrorist activity without any kind of confirmation, can go to a spy court and get permission to go to a library or bookshop, demand the records of a particular customer or a patron, and we as booksellers or librarians are silenced from even saying that this has occurred. That's wrong.
So we've come from a time in the Cramer decision and in the prior law when bookstores and libraries were given higher protection regarding search warrants and subpoena to a time now where they're given lower protection under the Patriot Act.
That's correct.
Joyce, we call our show Clear and Present Danger. What today do you consider the most clear and present danger to freedom of expression in the United States?
Well, that's a big question. Certainly the Patriot Act plays a keen role in the worry that surrounds booksellers and librarians and protecting their patrons and customers' privacy rights. But I think, too, it's our society's intolerance for ideas that differ from their own. And that's very dangerous.
Thank you for being with us and telling us your story.
Thank you.
Joyce Meskis is the owner of the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. She spoke recently with Stephen Rohde as part of a Clear and Present Danger segment, Pacifica's continuing series exploring the challenges of free expression in an open society. The series is a co-production of PEN USA and the Pacifica Radio Archives. The executive producer is Deborah Jones, the producer is Eileen Moskowitz, and the editor is Mark Torres. The show was recorded on location in Los Angeles. To obtain a copy, you can go to www.pacificaradioarchives.org. And to find out more about PEN USA, log on to their website at www.penusa.org. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.